With the inception and traction that blockchain and crypto has gathered, the world is possibly on the verge of the largest evolution since the mainstream of the internet. Given the fluidity and dynamic nature of this technology, business leaders, enthusiasts, and veterans all need to band together to navigate the current and upcoming storms. Participants in Web 3.0 want a trusted resource that gives them pertinent information about projects, tokens, technology, and businesses. We are business people talking the business of crypto. We are Y-Whales.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Y-Whales, wherever in the world you are today. Today is our Y-Web 3 Navigating Frontier Technologies yet again. This is a really cool episode we're doing. So we're taking a pause and doing, you know, hey, we're always about global events and we're still going to do a lot today. But we really wanted to focus in on Latin America. There is so much happening and I feel like Europe, United States, Asia generally gets a lot of the lion's share of the news and where everything's going. But there is so much going on down south from North America down with South America that we really just want to take a time and start talking about this. And so we have two amazing guests today. We're going to be talking not just about LATAM, but we're really going to be talking about, obviously cryptocurrencies, blockchain, regulation. And I think the big one that we're really going to be starting off with today is, what is freedom of speech? And if we're going to talk about, freedom of finance, we got to be able to talk about it. So I think there's some really interesting things happening today. It is April 9th, 2024. Bitcoin is just hovering right around that 70K mark. Don't know anyone that's going to be sad. I see people upset that Bitcoin's at 70. Just to remind us, a few months ago, we were down in the 20s. We're now up at 70 and people are feeling like the bull rush is already over. They clearly haven't done this a few times. And the NASDAQ is sitting at 16K. So with that, let's go ahead. And Lucia, love to have you kind of kick us off with, you've become a regular on the program and appreciate your time today.
Thanks. Well, thanks for having me. I honestly can't tell you how excited I am about this episode. Obviously, I have done projects in different parts of the world, but I was born and raised in Latin America. I'm Honduran by birth. And my entire sense of patriotism and bias is toward helping and supporting my country. So I think, I'm really excited to be here. For people that don't know me, I am the CEO and founder of a technology lab that essentially prototypes, experiments, et cetera, with new technology, namely blockchain and sustainable development goals. So we're trying to get, some impact going. We're trying to get people to consider the ways that they build in the space to account for environmental impacts, to account for social and humane impacts. So that's kind of been my expertise. And then on the side, I have, been an advisor to several governments and organizations and contributed to research in the space. And so I'm super excited to bring that sort of perspective toward a region that I hold very dear in my heart today.
Awesome. Fabulous. And first time appearing on the podcast, our very own Joanna, who has been with us with Y-Whales and, kind of in around the community and internationally recognized for her work in law related to blockchain and cryptocurrencies.
Hi, I'm Joanna. And yes, this is my first time at doing one of these. So I'm excited and a little nervous. Just a little bit about myself. I am a corporate attorney. In the past, I've had experiences as well advising the Salvadoran government for a brief period of time and then fully dedicated to corporate and now, new technologies and Web3, which I still have to say, I feel like a noob because every day I learn something new, but I am definitely excited of moving forward with the world and with Y-Whales because it's dear in my heart and with the entire community. So, always very excited to be part of ongoing transitions in the world.
Absolutely. And right now there is a lot going on. So I really want to start off with, again, the concept I just talked about, which is, freedom of speech. I've traveled the world. I don't travel as much as Lucia does, but I travel quite a bit and I get to see, often the repercussions for lack of freedom of speech. I spent some time, I'm American born, this is what I'm used to, which is, say what you want. And, sometimes people agree with you, sometimes don't, but, you can agree to disagree generally and move on. Traveling the rest of the world, it becomes a very interesting, conversation around what freedom of speech is. I spent some time in the UK this past year, and a lot of conversations ended up talking about freedom of speech. And I said, you guys really, it'd be great if you had freedom of speech, to which they all respond, of course we do. you just can't say anything mean and you can't say this and this and this and this and this. But of course, we have freedom of speech. And I think that really kind of dictates the differences that people have of what is the freedom of speech. Some, you know, people getting their feelings hurt is part of the repercussions of having different opinions. But the topic we want to dive in today, which is, I think, is a true boiling point going off and down in Brazil, is, you know, essentially this issue around Twitter, or they call it X now. Who knows? But essentially, Elon Musk, CEO of X, is now facing a criminal investigation in Brazil for alleging disinformation and obstruction of justice, leading to concerns about growing totalitarianism. And the situation underscores the pivotal role of free speech in democracy. So just as a real quick overview, what happened is one of the Supreme Court's justices that I guess wields a ton of power did a cease and desist and said, hey, we want you to remove all these profiles, all these people from being able to speak on X. But by the way, you can't tell them. We're not going to tell you why. We just want them removed. We want them removed immediately. There seem to be bothersome to us. Obviously, the rest of the social media crowds, Facebooks and Googles and all of them went ahead and did it, like they always do. They just say, yep, no problem. But Elon pushed back. And he said, no, this is not okay. They disclosed the fact that it was happening. Then they went ahead and said that it does not appear to be violating any law to do this. In fact, it appears to be violating laws to be censoring these people without due process, which was, again, for me, thank you for somebody to stand up and say, hey, you everyone is required due process. Now I'm going to go ahead and be quiet and let the two experts that actually understand what's going on down there, because it's turning into Elon's worried about his staff being arrested and is trying to extract them right now. Lucia, you want to kick this one off?
Sure. I mean, this is a complicated one, right? Because like in theory, yes, like you don't want people censoring anyone. But then it's like when you look at the list that they submitted, it was like they were banning the Brazilian Nazi Party, right? Like that was on the list. And so, I mean, there's a couple of factors at play here that make this a particularly interesting microcosm of what we need to talk about globally, which is, number one, this idea that like freedom of speech does not mean freedom of consequence, right? Like there are certain types of speech that historically have always been banned. You can't, you know, yell fire in a building, in a closed building or whatever. Like there are limitations to what you're inherently allowed to say. And we've kind of had this like unstated agreement and consensus that like saying certain things is not good and therefore should be banned. And so where is that, like, where are those lines drawn? And as we move into like an increasingly globalized and digital world where a lot of these conversations are taking place online, like, you know, in theory, no, the government should not be able to censor. But also the a question in my mind is also like, why does Elon get to decide that, right? But then X is a private platform. And so just like, you know, Elon as the CEO of this private platform can make the determinations for what is and is not allowed within a private platform, the government of Brazil can also say, well, then you can't operate in our country because our country has rules. And so it's a mix of all of these factors where like I, as a probably mostly libertarian, would say X is technically allowed to do whatever it wants. That doesn't mean Brazil has to allow for X to operate, right? And so because of that, I think it's a really compelling and interesting thing in saying, you know, this is a debate about freedom of speech. I don't know if it's so much a debate about freedom of speech so much as it is about these rules of how companies now operate in like in a new world where you can hop jurisdictions at leisure. You can go shopping for jurisdictions at leisure, where you can decide that you want to operate in some countries and not, where you can try to blackmail certain countries by threatening not to operate and offer services in their country, but then offer them in parallel countries. And so there's like all of these ways and power dynamics around the relationships between people in power across the private and the public sector that I think is really the deeper conversation that of what is changing. Because I think we've sort of held on to these notions about freedom of speech that are very dated, to be frank. And now there's conversations around like, well, what can and should be said in different jurisdictions? And also what, like who can and can't operate in different jurisdictions? So I think this is really like, everybody should be studying what's going on, not from the perspective of, you know, what accounts or whatever, because people will feel either way, which way about whether, you know, the Nazi Party should have a platform in Brazil or not. But what you should be looking at is the power dynamics. And I think this was a conversation that was sort of introduced as well with Uber, where Uber would like operate despite regulations and, you know, say, well, you know, we're going to operate anyway, and almost try to like force the hand of the city by having a bunch of people that wanted to drive for Uber initially, and then the city kind of being forced to allow them to operate eventually, right? And so this was one of those first conversations that I think opened the door to this discussion around what is changing between the power dynamics, and what is that? What are the implications of that in a power struggle when private companies want to offer services and people want access to globality, but then there are parameters around which a government will enable that company to operate. And I think that's the most interesting discussion about this topic in this headline.
I love that. And I want to, you know, just kind of ask a quick question, and then, mm-hmm. and then Joanna will go to you. So the way Elon describes free speech is, you know, freedom of speech, but not reach, where, you know, as long as what they're saying, you know, maybe hurtful, maybe whatever the case is, as long as what they're saying doesn't specifically violate a law, they can say it. But, you know, on his platform, he just goes, it won't be promoted. It's not going to be showcased. They use a lot, they're very heavy AI, and they just say it's there. But they're not going to promote it. You can't sponsor it. You can't boost it. You can't, whatever the case is, but you can say your words. The difference is, and I was unaware of the one party that you talked about, but when I did look at the list, it was all the opposition, which is relatively on the conservative side. So this is, you know, instead of the left, you know, they're saying it's the right. And they're just saying, look, this massive ban of people that are criticizing the government. And again, I'm not from Brazil, but, you know, it's my right as an American to criticize my government. And I can and should every single day because they deserve it. But, you know, Joanna, when you're kind of thinking about this and you think about, you know, everything that Lucia just kind of added in, you know, how do you feel like it's, you know, Elon standing up because he's an incredibly wealthy billionaire to these government officials that are deplatforming people? Like, is this as important as kind of the fight is turning into, or is this kind of a nothing burger, do you think?
What I personally think, and I'm in complete agreement with Lucia, is it's not a simple, straight answer. Why? Because, and I from experience can say, being American born, but with a Latin American background and currently, you know, based out of El Salvador, in America, you are taught that freedom of speech is an absolute
guarantee.
Exactly. Which in reality, it's not. It has its limitations. And within these limitations, you know, we could be things related to libel, slander, pornography, sedition, fighting words, anything related to war. You know, that's something that perhaps in the United States, it's not censored as much, but in the reality of LATAM, it is. And one thing I can say for me sitting here in San Salvador is the fact that when you have strong opinions against opposing to the government, you can be censored. And it happens on Twitter here in El Salvador. The government just blocks accounts. They don't ask Elon, like the Brazilian government did, to please, you know, remove this user. But they do block users. I've heard of it. I have people that I know from university, from work, that have been blocked because of their opinions. And it's a reality that perhaps in Northern America, in general, that including Canada and the US, it doesn't happen as often. But in LATAM, it does. And it's a reality. And one thing that really does catch my attention regarding the Elon Musk news on Brazil is the fact that it's not just a freedom of speech issue, but there's also decimation of fake news that has been brought to the attention of the government. And this is a huge issue because I can see why the government's like, no, I cannot accept that on my soil. And the government has their right to, like Lucia said, to ban certain things that are not according to what they want. I mean, unlike in the US, that it's not as easy, plus it's a much bigger country. You know, LATAM has smaller countries and it just works a little differently.
Before we start on our next topic, here's something really exciting. Everyone struggles with these really highly complex, you know, intricate Ethereum names. ENS has a solution that's really game-changing for you. Revolutionizing your digital identity with ENS. Transform long, complex Ethereum name addresses into easy-to-remember names, safely, securely, and uniquely yours. Visit ens.app to get started today, and ENS welcomes you to the new internet.
I think there's like three factors that need to be considered when assessing this from like the perspective of Latin America, which is number one, that Latin America has a really interesting history and dichotomy in political power, right? So historically speaking, you have a far left and a far right that has flip-flopped. And so I think it's something like the average is for every two far left, you get one far right government in most countries in Latin America. There's a couple that are reverse. And so they tend to be more twice far right and then once far left. But ultimately, there's been like this extremity that you're now starting to, you're now seeing very reflected in the US too, by the way. And I think this is the second factor, that there is an increasingly concerning movement towards extremes. And so you're starting to see where before people were a little bit more politically aligned on certain issues, like they felt at least there was some consensus on everyone deserves healthcare, everyone deserves quality education or whatever. This is becoming an increasingly smaller percentage of issues that people can seem to align on if they're on the right or on the left. And so because you're seeing sort of this like movement towards extremes, and you're seeing this across the entire world, even, I wouldn't say just Latin America, this has been happening in Latin America forever. And so because of that, the way that power shifts and the way that media control shifts is really, really volatile in our region. And so you can totally see media change as government changes. And so the way that they cover news, the headlines, who they point out, and so on and so forth, changes according to who's in power. Because the third factor that's really important here is that Latin America has a very strong history to military intervention in society, right? So you have countries, including my own, Honduras, for example, that had military rule from independence until 1982. It was like just military rule, right? And, you know, leaders in Latin America have resorted to using the military in many ways to exert and strengthen their control. And this, by the way, relates very much to these notions of fiat currency, because one of the biggest criticisms of fiat in history has been this idea that it is a system, an economic system that is upheld by military violence. And in Latin America, so is the media. And so because of that, when you're talking about, you know, freedom of speech in the context of Latin America, there's all of this like history and nuance of Latin America has historically sort of had to understand how to read its news under the context of who's in power, because it will shapeshift the narrative for a series of years and then change. And so I think, you know, there's more at play here than saying, you know, this is about freedom of speech. I think really this is a discussion about what does sovereignty mean, and where are the levels of sovereignty in government sovereignty, in private sector, you know, independence of company and mandate, especially for global companies that are headquartered in different countries, and then the sovereignty of the individual to be able to say what they want within the context of essentially what has been like really dominant politics across the region. Brazil is a microcosm, but this is something that can extend way past that.
So just real quick to jump in and have the American, you know, speak up from his perspective. Number one, now, you know, from my perspective, don't ever trust the government. You know, and that's, you know, kind of rule number one. Two is, you know, we're assuming that these people are informed or have a good understanding of this. And we were just right before the show started, we were watching a United States Congresswoman in all seriousness describing to a college about how the moon is made of gas and, you know, that you can just live inside the moon as this, it's made of gas, and the sun, you can get close to it. But it's not as nice as the moon. So we're going to focus on the moon. And by the way, this lady controls, she's controlling hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars at this lady's fingertips. And so I kind of use that as a dichotomy to just point out, like, just because they're in power doesn't mean that they actually have any clue what they're doing. Correct. And so my question to the both of you to wrap up this one is, Elon's not going to change his position. He doesn't care. It's not a money thing. Is Brazil, you know, better off with or without Twitter abiding by the rules as which Elon has says, which is freedom of speech, not reach, unless it's directly illegal, and they do abide by court ordered thing. So the question, you know, we'll see real quick is if Brazil loses X, is it a loss? Does it even mean anything to them?
I mean, honestly, at the rate that social media kind of penetrates across Latin America, you know, I mean, I personally, like, this is, I'm biased. Maybe Joanna would be better for this because I'm biased because I actually don't use it anymore. So it became a really toxic echo chamber for me. And so I just stopped using it. So I wouldn't miss it, that's for sure. But I can't extend that to other forms of social media that I continue to use and that continue to be incredibly valuable to me. And so I think I can independently and objectively say the world is better for having more social media platforms and more ways for people to connect independently. However, I can also understand that there is consequence to freedom of speech. And so when you are a platform that is allowing, you know, the Nazi Party a platform and is allowing for certain types of speech that, even though, you know, regulation hasn't necessarily dictated is illegal, may still be unethical. And you're kind of enabling that to take place despite, you know, objections and requirements and so on, then I think, you know, are you better off? I don't know. And I don't think so. I think there has to be some kind of way where you can work together to figure out, okay, fine, you can say it, but we won't publish it. Like, what does that mean? And where are those parameters? And if they can sit down and sort of find this harmonization of, you know, what we would call freedom of speech within the context of Latin America, and also of the way that political extremities have sort of been taking shape around the world, because this is a conversation that's going to have to take place in more places. You know, like, I'm pretty sure they can't go into Saudi Arabia or they can't go into Jordan or monarchies and say, you know, oh, well, we're just going to do it in spite of whatever you say. But somehow they think that doing it in Brazil is okay, right? And so I think this is a conversation that is going to be front and center in the future going forward. And that's why I think everyone should be paying attention to this issue. Do I think that Brazilians are better off without X? I think Brazilians are better off having many ways to communicate and many ways to express freedoms and understand what the parameters are on what that freedom of expression means from both the government and the platforms that enable that.
Very interesting perspective. Joanna, same question.
Not only that, but as Lucia said, and I do agree, both the private sector and the public sector need to sit down and establish parameters. Not necessarily does X have to go away from Brazil, but there needs to be a parameter that X is allowed to follow. And if there's something that's posted that perhaps, you know, incentivizes this hate, for example, it could just be removed. Instagram does it. Facebook does it. And it's not something that other platforms don't do it. And me personally, I do have Twitter, but I don't post on it. I just, you know, keep updated on news because there's a lot of platforms I do follow. But because I am a Salvadorian authorized attorney, because of this whole freedom of speech that we were talking about just a couple of minutes ago, and this whole opposing opinions to the government, sometimes it's just not wise to post online your opinions. Particularly because I don't just work with El Salvador, I work with the U.S. as well. So I just rather stay neutral. And again, you know, unfortunately, it's just easier to be chased around from your, you know, political opinions in situations as those. So again, and like Lucia said, it's a toxic environment. Twitter is toxic overall. So, you know, and people just start hating on you without even knowing you. And just, you know, part of respecting the freedom of speech is respecting someone else's opinion and respecting the fact that you might not always see eye to eye.
I think the only point I'm going to counter is I think the world would be better with no social media. If we can go back to the 90s, it seemed to be working better for all of us. So, you know, if you're going to allow one, we'll go there. But,
I do have to say myself, back in the 90s, I was much younger, and at least I was not the generation of kids that would play on a tablet. I would actually ride my bike and play with my neighbors. So
I would dispute that, right? Because I think for a lot of people, social media has brought a lot of issues into the light that has enabled discussions to be had that are really, really important. I mean, like, I really love this idea that people can organize themselves regardless of their immediate surroundings and the people that, you know, are around them. But they could, you know, connect with someone in an entirely different country and culture that seems to be going through authoritarian rule, or that seems to be going through, you know, natural disaster, that seems like the idea that the world can be organized and collected toward things that make people's lives more meaningful and things. I think that's really exciting. And I think that was initially the premise of social media, was really to connect. Well, I mean, maybe not Facebook, that was founded on the premise of like rating women. But, you know, I think this idea of like connectedness is really exciting. And I think the world is better for it. But I also think it's one of those things that it's like innovation. You never know where that's going to take you. And we could say the same thing about blockchain, right? Like we never know where, like all of the things that we're building now, we don't have a certain lens of where this is going to go in 10, you know, 15, 20 years. And we're going to get to a headline around CBDCs being like anti-corruption tools. And I'm going to talk about it like that. But, you know, I think for the most part, I'm a very big supporter of social media, but I also think, you know, we have taken this concept of like self-sovereignty and like freedom of speech to such a degree that now even saying, hey, words have consequences is considered like an assault on freedom. And that's, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Like freedom exists within the context of everything that's around you, right? Like your freedom might also mean someone else's oppression. And that is something that we need to be able to talk about in order to be able to create more freedom that is actually like legitimately living up to the word and enabling other people to also share in that and partake in that.
It is a conversation that we could spend months and years on, and we'll pick it back up again. But jump into our next story, which I think is really interesting, and it's right there near Joanna. It is generally, like I said, crypto is not, you know, blockchain, crypto is not kind of like high on everyone's list every single day of the week. You know, sometimes it's accepted, sometimes it's not. Depends, you know, which political party is in power. But El Salvador, President Nayib introduced a transformative initiative inviting global talents to become citizens and contribute to the country's progress. He's giving 5,000 free passports, which he's estimating is worth $5 billion, to skilled professionals, which includes voting rights, really aimed at boosting innovation and development. So if you take the 5,000 passports and the $5 billion, you can clearly see he wants people that are going to come and bring $10 million or more, of which he's saying will be tax-free. There's not going to be any tax on the initial money coming in. That doesn't mean it's not going to be coming out, but he really wants to attract some wealthy individuals. And, you know, there's been a lot of changes in your country recently, Joanna, but, you know, let's start with you on there. You know, what's your thoughts on this? Is it a good program? It represents, you know, 0.01% of the population. So it's a tiny amount of people. But it's getting headlines everywhere.
Oh, it is. In the first 24 hours, like I mentioned to you before the podcast began, there has been at least 400 applications already submitted. So it's definitely something that is, you know, making El Salvador once again put on the map, top of the mind. And what I personally think regarding this piece of news is the fact that he's not only trying to attract investment, he's also trying to attract people who have the skill set to help him move his projects forward. For example, a couple of weeks back, he announced that he wanted to create a nuclear plant in El Salvador. And because of how education has been manifested in the last couple of decades in El Salvador, perhaps there are people who are skilled in this science, but he wants to have someone perhaps who has not just the academic knowledge, but who has also the experience. So that could be a case of example of what he is trying to attract, plus all other incentives that he's currently having. You know, this is not the only piece of incentive that he has to bring people in. There's also tax incentives, for example, for tech companies that have lately been approved in the legislative branch, which as well is trying to bring money. At the end of the day, that's what it's trying to bring: more money to the country, more job opportunities. And not only that, again, like I said, the level of expertise that he needs to, you know, someone actually manage these projects. Which, I mean, at the end, it's good for the country. I mean, El Salvador, up until a couple of years ago, was known for its violence, for, you know, its economic issues. And at least now we're in the news for good things, not negative things. And, you know, I do see it every day. It's been slow. It's been a slow process. But I can say from at least 5 years till now, El Salvador has changed a lot.
And I mean, obviously, you know, Bitcoin is legal tender there. So for people that don't understand, you know, El Salvador, you just want to give an overview of you know, kind of the blockchain crypto initiatives just real quick.
Well, Bitcoin was accepted as, well, was legalized as legal tender back in 2021. Like I said to you a couple minutes back, one of the biggest issues that was part of the adoption of Bitcoin itself was because at the beginning, since it was such new technology in the country, not the world, but in this country, was the fact that there was only the Bitcoin platform to work upon. So there was no access, or at least at the beginning, to the Lightning Network, the second layer added to the Bitcoin network, and transactions were being a little slow. And then when you had people coming in from other countries who wanted to use Bitcoin, and they were asking about the Lightning Network, a lot of people didn't know what it was, or if they did have it already, didn't know how to use it. But, you know, it's an education issue as well, because when Bitcoin was implemented as legal tender, there were no educational programs at the time. Now we do have a couple. There's actually one that's called Mi Primer Bitcoin, which is My First Bitcoin, which is doing, you know, educational courses for people to understand how it's used, where you can use it. And, you know, that has definitely made a change. And there's also a lot of, you know, foreigners coming in and trying to get residency. And a lot of people, you know, they are actually taking care of from the mouth to mouth type of education, which also helps here, particularly in the more rural areas of the country. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's definitely helped. But overall, right now, from 2021 till 2024 now, it has increased a percentage of the population, the 6.3 million people that we are in the country. About, I could say, maybe 10% of the people use it now. Before it was 2%. So that's a huge increase.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. And that's thanks to these types of initiatives, because we are now having more people coming in from all over the world. We have people from France, Australia, the US, and even other LATAM countries coming in to because of the Bitcoin movement, which is huge.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Lucia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a smart move. Like, you, if you think about the perspective of smaller countries, including the one I'm currently in, I'm in Cayman Islands, one of the things that they need to think about is, like, how do you build an economy when you have limited resources, limited land, limited whatever? You need to think about, like, you know, exportable talent. So business is generally the way to do that. And in today's world, if it's not innovation, it's not business at this point, right? And so I think this idea of, like, trying to find, you know, what things do innovation hubs need to flourish? You need money. So, you know, by enabling this access to, like, alternative assets and cryptocurrencies, by creating different means by which you can access money and wealth, I think that's, you know, enabling that. The second thing you need is obviously talent, right? And so you need the opportunity to be able to either bring in talent. And so the fact that it's, like, a limited number of passports, I think, is brilliant, because then that enables the second part of, you know, creating talent, which is, like, okay, how do these experts then bring in local talent and train them and enable the skills to be shared across boards? So then ultimately that's what creates, like, the overall improvement on, like, the country's opportunity for upward economic mobility. And so talent is a big one. And then the third thing that you need is connection to markets, right? And so when you do have this ability to bring in expats that have different types of expertise and networks, the networks that come with them are really valuable, because if you have entrepreneurs that are, or, like, you know, business people that are coming to El Salvador to, spark something or create something, and they're connected to ecosystems in foreign markets, then you're opening this channel by which you can sell whatever you're building on land toward other markets. And so this idea of building these pipelines for money, talent, and, you know, connectivity to foreign markets, I think that's really critical. So I think that's a brilliant move on that front. You know, I've had mixed feelings about the way that El Salvador has gone through its Bitcoin strategy, as we all know, because I've said it every single podcast episode. But overall, I think it's one of those things that it's a smart move. And I think John is right. Like, you used to hear about El Salvador's murder rate, and now you hear about El Salvador's innovation hub. And I think that's, you know, an important narrative that has done a world of good in at least creating hope for people and in like helping them think about what is possible in economic growth that I think was something completely in the dark before.
You know, and I think the thing that's really interesting to me is it's being led by their Department of Education.
Yeah.
Meaning that they're really focused on the next generation of El Salvadorians, if that's what you guys call yourselves. But really being able to kind of say, like, look, we want to bring in talent, but it's to kind of make up for a few lost decades per se. You know, education, you know, is any first world country, any higher educated society, like, you got to start with the kids and move your way up from there. So I think it's really interesting that they're not saying, like, hey, Department of Commerce and who's going to make us the most money. But they're actually kind of making sure the Department of Education is involved and in fact leading this. So I think it'd be really interesting to see kind of how that all integrates. Do you have any more details on that?
I do have to add one thing that I think was my biggest criticism at the beginning, and I did mention it a couple minutes back, is the fact that one of the things that I did think from the beginning that was making the Bitcoin adoption so slow was the lack of education. And one thing that has changed from 2021 till now is the fact that you are getting the correct ministries involved. Like you just said, you know, education is the number one factor other than just the technology for this to actually happen. Because it's not that the Salvadorian is not interested in learning. Of course they are. It's money. Who does not want money and better opportunities for their country?
Mm-hmm. So, Honduras, they just banned cryptocurrencies, but whatever. I told you I was going to get myself in trouble on this thing.
No, but hey, let's not go too far. In 2017, investments in cryptocurrency were illegal in El Salvador.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're illegal now. They were not even regulated in Honduras up until recently, where they decided to make them illegal, and I'm so mad.
And it's crazy because we're neighbors.
I know, right next door.
And I
don't know why though, because we have some headlines that relate to like control and stuff that, you know, obviously played a huge role in making it illegal, but it's just one of those things where, like, we're neighboring countries and they have two drastically opposite positions on cryptocurrency. And it just saddens me. I was born in the one that was more resistant to change.
Like Guatemala, who's our other neighbor, Guatemala is still like in the middle. They're like, okay, maybe we like it, but there's a couple of things we're not sure about.
Yeah. We're not saying no, but
yeah, they're not saying no, but they're not saying yes.
Which is okay to be neutral, you know, for, you know, and these are a lot of, you know, very small countries, you know, and, you know, I don't know what their GDP is, but it's, you know, a wrong move could, you know, really spell doom for these countries. So I always am like, look, if you don't want to, you know, adopt it perfectly, just don't ban it and continue to kind of watch where things are going and regulate it and, you know, KYC it and everything else. Now, again, we've talked about some of the we have a kind of a negative-ish story with X. We have a very positive one with this. And now we've got a lot of, you know, chaos going down there. So Mexico withdraws diplomats from the embassy in Ecuador after security forces stormed the building to arrest former Vice President Jorge Glass. There's still, you know, a lot of, like, as you said, militaristic rule going on. You know, how does somebody who's, you know, because I think there's going to be a lot more interest over the next decade, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be, I think, a lot of people that will move to Latin America. We're seeing I know so many New Yorkers, we have one in our company that moved from New York, you know, down to Mexico and they're like, this is great. This is amazing. So I think we're going to see this massive kind of like reshifting of a lot of people around the world. LATAM is going to win big. But how do you kind of gauge, you know, which countries actually have stability? Because clearly there's something strange going on in Ecuador.
You don't. Honestly, like, you shouldn't assume any country has stability, because we've just seen time and time again that, like, just when you think a country's stable, something happens. But here's what you have to understand about Latin America. Latin America is a really phenomenal region for a couple of reasons. The first is that it has so much wealth in terms of culture, in terms of population, in terms of nature. It's like really a region that has everything in it to be one of the, you know, foremost regions in the world. And the reason that it can't become that is because it's held back by a legacy of institutional corruption. And this, it doesn't matter who's in power. Corruption is part of, you know, the game. And you know, it's a question of, like, are they being corrupt and doing things, or are they just being corrupt and then not moving the country forward? And that's really, like, and it's sad to say, really, like, I've, you know, grown up around this my entire life. And I know that there's corruption in other countries. I know the US has, you know, its own form of corruption. But in Latin America, it's really something that has held it back so much. And so actually, when I first got into crypto, my first foray into understanding what this technology was a research project. So I spoke to about, you know, 448 blockchain projects across different emerging market regions in the span of like 3 months. And we put it into like a summarized report, which we put online for free. But in that process, we know, you know, we've been talking to people, entrepreneurs and developers and investors and whatever in Southeast Asia who were, you know, completely taken by the potential for, you know, financial revolution and banking services and fintech and so on. And you were speaking to, you know, the same kind of ecosystem in Africa, and they were completely, you know, mesmerized by the idea of like trading, you know, sustainable energy. And they were looking at ways to enable the fact that, like, you know, in Africa, there's a lot of space in between towns and villages sometimes. And so banking infrastructure is really complicated. So peer-to-peer mobile payments, you know, were super exciting to them. And you saw them be pioneers in that. And Eastern Europe was like, hey, you know, we don't, other than like Russia, maybe Ukraine, like, we don't have a ton of natural resources. So building economies out of like outsourcing to us, or building exchanges, or building gambling services, that was exciting to them. So you got to see like the patterns of how the economic development of the region for the past 50, 60 years was informing the way they were looking at blockchain as an opportunity. And then you got to Latin America, and what was super compelling about, you know, what interested me about how they were thinking about it was like all about transparency. Like, everyone I spoke to in Latin America was completely consumed by this idea that blockchain could bring about transparency. And it's like, it tells you a lot about the region, because it tells you that corruption and mistrust in government and fear of government and all of these factors were really like top of mind for anyone that was even thinking about this technology back in 2015. Right? They were already thinking about transparency as the dominant use case. It was beyond money and currency. It was really thinking like, can this assuage corruption, and like, can this boost trust in our region? And so when you take that into perspective, I think it really tells you that Latin America is a region that is ripe with opportunity because it's been held back by institutional corruption for so long. And then at the same time, you kind of learn how to read some of the patterns to understand like, hey, something's going on, something's not going on. Because if you look at the entire political and like history of Latin America, the patterns have never changed. Like, really, the patterns are completely the same across the country. Like, if you look at the country and you look at the last 50 or 60 years of political dynamics, you will spot the exact same thing. Maybe the words are different, the people are different. And now it's on a globalized stage, but the patterns stay completely the same. And that is both devastating for the region, but also it means that it is an interesting market, because even though you feel it's unpredictable because you're looking from the outside in, once you're in it, it's actually highly predictable. And it's ripe with people that are, you know, smart, but looking for an opportunity to thrive because they have been unable to get like move past a lot of these institutional barriers over time. And so this idea that, you know, globalized technology can come in and interrupt that and create opportunities that are outside of what is an institutional barrier, I think is super exciting to the region. And I think, you know, it's why you sort of have seen a lot of the markets respond to cryptocurrency. Like, Ethereum Foundation has a grant program in Honduras, although not anymore because it's banned. But it had one in Colombia, and it, you know, Argentina contributed so much to Ethereum infrastructure. And you have, you know, tons of Venezuelans using Bitcoin, and you've got El Salvador legalizing it as tender, and you've got regulation going on all across the space. And you've got the Inter-American Development Bank building a network of blockchain protocols that people can leverage. And so when you sort of see all of the activity that's happening, it's happening because people are excited by the prospect of this technology being a global force that fights against something that has historically held the region back. And that's what, to me, makes Latin America so special and interesting as a place to center your innovation on from.
So with that point, and again, financial freedom, financial transparency, anti-corruption, all these things, which again, I'm all for. I'm 100% like you are correct. I'm going to jump back, which I rarely do, to our first story. If you don't have freedom of speech, if you don't have the ability to talk about these things and to say, I think that this person's corrupt, I think this is wrong, whether they're right or wrong, whether you think the earth is flat or not, or the moon is made up of gas, you know, but you have to be able to say and invest and to move the money the way you want. How do you draw parity between freedom of speech and freedom of finances?
But you do have freedom of speech. And this is where I think Joanna pointed this out really well, is this idea that, like, in the US, freedom of speech is like this really extreme, like, freedom. It's like an untouchable, you can say whatever you want kind of thing. But in other parts of the world, there's, like, even I would argue, like, in the Middle East and in you know, in certain, like, even in Europe, there's, like, things that are just completely looked down upon for you to say. Like, it's not, you know, because they tend to be, like, more on the left side of life, right? And so mm-hmm. you start to see, again, these, like, dichotomies of power sort of dictate what is okay to say in that moment and what's not. But in Latin America, like, you can say things. Like, it's not like, you know, you can't. But it's just, like, what is the context of what you're saying? If you are saying, you know, like, one of the things that the government of Brazil said about, like, jumping back to the first story was, like, one of the reasons that they can't have those people on X speaking so freely is that they were calling into question electoral fraud. Like, they were basically saying, like, there was electoral fraud that was ripe, but they presented no evidence to do that. And there is also a formal legal channel for you to present an objection to the way elections were held. Like, you can file a lawsuit and file a claim. Like, there's ways for you to do that. So freedom of speech does not mean freedom to say whatever, whenever, however I want. Like, you can still say, hey, these elections, I think, were fraudulent, go to court, say that, submit evidence against that. There's a process for it, right? And so I think, like, what I think is the perspective that I'd love people to have on not just Latin America, but really market, like, other geographies, is this idea that, like, the freedom of speech is not the ultimate freedom that it is in the US. What it is like the ability to be able to express things. And that might take different shapes. You might have to go to court to do it. You might have to submit a bill to do it. I, like, at the age of 17, submitted a bill for consideration to Congress. There's also ways for you to say things. And so I think the harmonization that needs to take place, and I think the cultural shock that people might encounter when trying to operate in Latin America, is precisely that. It's that, you know, we have, like, this contextual awareness that guides some of the decision making and the things that we say. That doesn't mean I can't say it. It just means I'm going to choose the way I'm going to say it, and I'm going to choose the pathway to do it. And I think once you understand how to navigate that nuance across one of the countries, you can be really successful as a foreigner doing business in the region. You just have to understand that there are contextual considerations and there are pathways that are predetermined that can get you further than going on X and saying whatever it is you want to say without consequence.
Very interesting perspective. Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Beyond Enterprises, the ultimate 360-degree partner for companies ready to embrace the power of blockchain in their business strategies. Beyond Enterprises stands out as a beacon of expertise with a blockchain-agnostic approach that has seen successful projects on Ethereum, EOS, and Arc. Guided by blockchain thought leaders and fueled by inspired advisors, the team has played a pivotal role in over 40 successful ventures spanning token generation events, security token offerings, exchanges, and more. From healthcare to travel, finance, and beyond, Beyond Enterprises has left a massive mark on diverse industries. Elevate your business strategy today with pioneers of blockchain integrations, Beyond Enterprises, trusted 360 partner.
It all comes down to having common limitations. There are certain things that by common sense, you know, that you can say on a social platform. And like Lucia said, and there are other contexts that is now being pointed out as fake news of what Elon was pointing out that needs to be said in a different context because it brings different consequences. You can't come about in the world and point someone to be guilty of something on a social network and then expect to have a correct outcome. You need to have proof to say something. That's what it comes down to. Know how to say things and where to say it.
How controversial is this episode going to be?
Oh, listen, I'm taking the brunt of this as, like I said, the one yank on the program here.
No worries. Like it's an interesting discussion, right? But it's just like cultural, because you guys went to war on the basis of freedom, right? Like that was the narrative was around like freedom.
No taxation without representation.
Right. And so everything about like, and in our case, like it was wars of independence, but it was a wildly different context because a lot of like the people that were in Latin America were being enslaved or were being oppressed in very different ways than the two types of like for African Americans, that might be like, that is a totally common experience across Latin America and, you know, enslaved Black people in the US. But like the War of Independence for the U.S. was really this idea of like freedom, and it was guided by principles of freedom that have been preserved to a very high degree in ways that other parts of the world have simply not. Like in other parts of the world, there are limitations to freedom, and there are, and it's a really interesting perspective. And as someone who has traveled the world a fair bit and who has lived in, you know, in the US for bouts of time, in Canada for bouts of time, in Europe for bouts of time, and you know, and I've spent time in the Middle East, and I've spent time in Latin America and in the Caribbean. And so as someone that's kind of been able to see all of these different versions of freedom, I think I'm always intrigued by the degree to which freedom is fought for and like expressed in the US versus the pragmatic notion of freedom that perhaps dominates in other cultures. And so I think Latin America, you know, can have lots of freedom if you understand what freedom means within the context of a more pragmatic approach to it.
It's very interesting.
I do think that in particularly from the US, if Americans understood this concept around freedom and not thought of it as it's thought in the US itself, they would have an easier time adopting and, you know, just living outside in any other country that's not the US. Because the US works one way, the rest of the world works in a very different way.
This is true. But yes. Even in the US, like there's so much subtlety in like living in different states depending on the historical evolution and the politics of the particular state. And so I think, yeah, it's just quite fascinating, but I have a feeling that this will be a very interesting episode to some people.
Yeah, very much so. Let's talk a little bit about crypto while we're all here, because I think there's actually a few interesting stories and whatnot. And the first is, you know, if you were an investor from 23 leading into 24, so if you were with us in the bear and listened to these episodes, of which we were like, look, everyone's building, it's not dead, we're just not getting any media attention. The average investor is, you know, up over $2,800. We can see their platforms, we can see their portfolios, and that's huge. So to have the average, which again, let's not talk about 23, but the average in 24 means that we are net positive. That means that the ecosystem is growing, it's moving in the right direction. There's a number of stories around this, you know, right now, which we're seeing, you know, kind of growth and you know, partnerships being formed by traditional companies like MasterCard and Banex, you know, with Web3, you know, kind of integrations in a variety of ways. So, you know, as we kind of let's keep it with a LATAM type, you know, context here. But we're starting to see this become real useful technology. We're starting to see that, you know, the credit card rails, which, you know, this piece of plastic with a magnetic stripe or magnetic chip, which is what everyone used to transact on, that's the standard. The standard, I don't believe, is in any way, shape, or form going to be like, hey, what's your crypto wallet address? I'm going to send you money while you're in the checkout. We've already got great payment rails, but now how can we integrate Web3? are you seeing any of this, you know, occurring? You know, Joanna, you were talking about the Lightning Network and other things. Like, is anyone actually transacting in crypto that you're seeing? And then Lucy will go to you.
Yes, there's a fair amount of people who are transacting. And since, again, it's legal tender, I say supposedly because there are some types of commerce that don't accept other cryptocurrencies, just Bitcoin, because it's legal tender. And because, again, some don't actually know how to use it. But Bitcoin is used a lot, particularly in the area of the beach. The beaches in El Salvador in general, it's filled with expats and and there's also ATMs dedicated to Bitcoin, which is really nice. You know, people can actually transact easier with fiat and convert it to Bitcoin and vice versa. There's also a lot of, farmers markets dedicated to Bitcoin transactions. There's one down in El Sonte, which is like every other day. And people are, you know, transacting and buying produce and what, like ceviche and other types of, you know, food from the coast and transacting in Bitcoin. And nowadays, there's actually a platform that even makes it easier for people to even make, you know, like utility payments, which is called Britfill. And it has anything from bills, food, games, clothing. You can buy eSIMs on this,
okay,
on this platform with Bitcoin, and it helps you transact. And in the case that you go to a commerce that for some reason does not accept cryptocurrency, because this is not just Bitcoin, it's other types of crypto, you could just buy a card in this platform and transact that way.
Now, just real quick for my own ignorance, are they talking about it in terms of how many sats, or are they converting it to local currency and there's DeFi involved? Like, you know,
it depends. Some people are converting.
Okay.
Because some people, they don't fully trust and understand Bitcoin. They're still converting it to fiat.
Okay.
And then there's another portion or percentage of people that are actually just fully transacting in Bitcoin.
Interesting.
I know a couple of people, I have a couple friends that from way before Bitcoin was actually legal tender here, was already mining Bitcoin.
Okay.
From back in 2015, 2016. So it's something that they're very familiarized with. And now, you know, it's just their way of transacting because they are so familiar with it and they love it. I mean,
and they're crypto, and they're crypto rich.
Exactly. Some people are actually crypto rich.
Cool. Yeah, I've met a lot of those. I think the region is, it's like happening, you know, first of all, can I just say MasterCard has really, really seized its moment. Like, I think that they just have understood blockchain really as like a means to an end. And so you see all of these different approaches that they're taking. Like, it's offering buy, sell, hold services to banks. It's offering debit cards. It's offering credit cards. It's offering, you know, it's incorporating NFTs into its strategy. It's incorporating impact-driven initiatives into its strategy around their Priceless Planet Coalition. Like, they've done collaborations in the NFT space with entertainment. Like, they've really looked at this technology as a tool and said, hey, how do we embed this into the MasterCard core competency of, you know, being a fintech company? And I think that that's really exciting. And I'm super, you know, thrilled with the way that they've sort of gone about that. I don't know the Visa ecosystem enough, but I can tell you that, like, from what I know about MasterCard, which, you know, I have the privilege of also dealing with them on the regular, is that they've really leaned into this. And part of that has been looking at Latin America and trying to figure out like how to get these services up and running. And they haven't been the only ones. Like, Inter-American Development Bank has, you know, its own blockchain ecosystem. It's got like, I think their testnet has like 45 nodes and like 27 organizations running projects on it. And then their mainnet has like 17 organizations running projects on it. And so, you know, they've got hundreds of projects actually like running through these organizations. I think one of them is like COVID vaccines. I think 8 health ministries of health organized their COVID vaccine recognition through this blockchain collaboration with the Inter-American Development Bank. I've seen a lot around university credentialing. About 2,000 universities are about to issue education credentials through a blockchain network. I've seen a fair bit of projects around supply chain. I've seen attempts around like digitizing bills of lading and ladling and so on around import export. I've seen lots of projects around financial inclusion, though those have been probably to a lesser tier just by virtue of like the difficulty of, you know, regulation and lack of clarity around regulation in a lot of the markets excepting El Salvador and then on occasion Paraguay. Panama has looked at, from the central bank perspective, conditional cash transfers through blockchain. So I think like it is a region that is happening, that is considering, at least most countries, obviously not mine, have tried to at least look at different use cases and figure out, you know, what we're going to pick and choose here. I think a big piece of it has also been like Latin America is building its innovation culture in real time. And you've got a lot of countries that are, this is like their first foray into like hardcore innovation circles. And so like, as you look at like the maturity of different projects, you start to see like variance in some of the countries and what they're able to achieve. Like what Argentina's been able to do in the blockchain space is much more elevated than other countries because they had developers that were kind of more prepped for this. Whereas other countries are not only building a blockchain ecosystem, they're building their first innovation entrepreneurship ecosystem. You're starting to see countries that before didn't even have like incubators or accelerators suddenly have them. And so I think it's a really exciting time because it's one of those like instances where I think people have heard blockchain can help economies leapfrog, but this is happening in real time in Latin America. And so you are seeing leapfrogging go from like blockchain culture to AI culture, to innovation culture, to fintech culture, and all of that sort of happening at the same time, which is particularly exciting.
And I have to say that from listening to some expats talk about El Salvador and this whole movement, and not only it's just at a local level, but also like banks are getting involved. And most of the banks now in El Salvador do accept Bitcoin and Bitcoin accounts and all that. So it's actually huge. But what I've heard from expats are a lot are almost running away from the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
Because they feel that they do not have freedom.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So real quick, as we kind of, you know, wrap up the episode, and to be honest, this is one of my favorites because it's just been really good to talk, you know, a lot about just understanding of the political natures and the thoughts. There are differences, you know, don't like as an American, I don't ever expect to show up in a different part of the world and everyone to adhere to me. Although that is the American way that we're the center of the universe. It's just not the reality. So I think it's very helpful to hear you guys' perspectives. The last point I'd like to ask is what's it like building a business? If you actually wanted to move your company, whether that's a Web3 blockchain company or a traditional company, you know, it, which countries in Latin America are at this point right now preference to do so? And which ones would you maybe want to shy away from if that's a way to ask the question?
Well, if you're going to build a blockchain-based business, maybe stay away from the ones that have made it illegal. but I think actually one of the cool things about Latin America is that like regulation is changing. Like, and it's one of those regions where you can very quickly in the span of, you know, a couple of weeks or months even end up in meetings with regulators and in meetings with the right authorities. Like if you know how to navigate the culture and like the environment, it's pretty easy to get to a point where like you are contributing to policy discussions on how this is going to go moving forward. So I think that's a critical opportunity there. I really, you know, Chile has been working really hard to build up its startup culture. They've got like major startup programs trying to attract people from forming businesses there, although their economy, you know, ebbs and flows, but it's, you know, you can get really good talent. You can get lots of incentives from the government. I think Colombia's had great success in attempting the same. Panama is a huge, you know, market where lots of foreign businesses have sort of set up shop because English is completely pervasive. There's a lot of foreign money there. There's a lot of parked money there. So Panama's been like, and it's an interesting nexus between Central and South America. So I think Panama's had a lot of success in trying to get businesses up and going. Obviously, El Salvador for like net crypto businesses is a really interesting economy. I think Mexico, from the fintech perspective, it's always kind of been trying to create the right conditions and policy to enable fintech innovation generally, and then specifically blockchain innovation as well. There's lots of hunger for projects in Mexico. It's also, you know, you can build in Mexico, export to the US with no problem under NAFTA. deals and trade. So I think there's like a couple of exciting markets, and also lots of love to the Caribbean. I love the Caribbean. Obviously, like, you know, Cayman Islands is a popular destination. Bermuda is a popular destination. Barbados is a popular destination, and prioritizing innovation in climate, ocean innovation, and health. So there's lots of exciting, you know, things happening. But I think those countries particularly stand out by virtue of what they're trying to accomplish within building their innovation hubs. In terms of, you know, the experience of building a business, I think a big, you know, piece of it is understanding how to tap into, again, those critical factors, right? Which is money. Where is your money going to come from? Latin America has lots of money, but it doesn't have like the organized VC strength that you would find in the US or that you would find in Europe, for example. So you can find money, but it might be a little bit less organized as you're familiarized with it. If you're from, you know, one of these economies that has like really structured, like, seed to Series C kind of structures, that you would find less in a lot of the economies. And you find a lot of these economies are trying to build, you know, investor cultures, which is also an exciting opportunity, because if you are someone that's looking to build funds, like Latin America happens to be looking for this organization so that they can better invest in their innovation culture. So that's a huge opportunity across the space. Just don't try to like translate the Silicon Valley model, because it does not work in Latin America. That's been tried and tested and failed. But that's an interesting opportunity. And then I think looking at just like the particular country economies and what can be leveraged there. I think, you know, Latin America exports a lot. There's coffee, there's cocoa, there's fruit, a lot of, you know, supply chain opportunities. There's a lot of, you know, agricultural finance, credit finance opportunities. Financial inclusion opportunities, because it's a very interesting market in terms of, you know, access levels to banking. There's a huge informal market. So there's lots of opportunities. And I think, you know, one of the things I would also ask people to consider is like to really get to know culturally what's going on, right? Because one of the lessons that I've A, learned myself, but B, tried to continuously teach through my work in, you know, over the span of a decade, has been this idea that like there is a lot of important nuance that can lead to successful adoption when you understand it. So an example of this is if you're trying to understand the consumer, like the everyday consumer, in the Middle East, the studies on this are amazing, by the way, and I've put them in some folder that I need to dig up again. But basically, in the Middle East, the decision-making process from when you decide you want to buy something to actually buying it for young Middle Easterners is on average 3 minutes, which is nothing. It's like they decide, I want a plane ticket or I need a new phone or whatever. They search for it. And then 3 minutes later, they've acquired it. So if you are entering the Middle East and you're not like heavy on the SEO, you're probably not going to do that great, because they're not going to hunt for you. They're just going to go for convenience, and convenience is like reputation of brand and convenience are the two greatest factors in decision-making for purchasing in the Middle East. But when you look at Latin America, it's very different. In Latin America, convenience is actually very low on the spectrum. But price comparison is very high, trust is very high. And so there was a study done that was something like Latin Americans on average are willing to drive up to 45 minutes to guarantee that they'll get the best price for something. Wow. So if you are trying to enter the Latin American market and you're not offering like price comparisons, or you're not guaranteeing, you know, price matching, you know, on certain product offerings, then you're going to have a harder time penetrating that market. So really understanding like what is the nuance of the population and the market I'm trying to enter, I think is really like the key to like navigating the region. And I think it's just something that most innovators kind of leave as secondary for like when they grow, because they're maybe product focused or whatever. But I think understanding these nuances leads to much greater success in Latin America. And we've seen certain companies sort of be able to do that and just do very, very well. And we've seen cryptocurrencies inadvertently like be that way. And so they've led to greater adoption, and you sort of see people trading in them much more often. And so, so I'd advocate, you know, nuance always.
Love it. That was a master's class right there. Joanna, bring us home. You've set up companies for Y-Whales really all around the world. You've dealt with so many different jurisdictions. And any thoughts, as we're closing this up?
I have to say, and for from the moment that you ask, the top three countries that come to mind that would be the best oriented in the space and to actually incorporate a company for me would be Mexico, El Salvador, currently because of all the regulation that we have in the space, and Colombia. Colombia, particularly right now, they're moving forward in the crypto space. And I've in the past worked for a Colombian company that, you know, foreign corporation, it's very quickly, you know, and Colombians are very straightforward with incorporation, and so are the Mexicans. Plus, they have very big economies. They have a lot of products to export, and not just products, but also human talent. Particularly in the region, they have very good education. So I do believe that these are the three top countries currently to do business in LATAM.
That's huge.
Because they're very straightforward with regulation. They're very straightforward with what is to be done. And there is not so much bureaucracy compared to other countries in the region.
This has been really an amazing episode. I think we're going to have to do more of these, you know, geographic ones. And we're going to also need to kind of keep an update on this one, you know, probably annually. So thank you, ladies, so much for that. That was highly interesting to hear from my perspective. Like I said, I've done a lot of travel, spent a lot of time with a number of people around the world, but to really see and hear from, you know, boots on the ground, you know, you guys have lived it, you're there, you're seeing it, and you're conducting business there. You know, what a massive opportunity is. And for people that are struggling right now, and I say this with nothing but pain in my heart as a you know, red blood and red, white, and blue American, it's too hard to do it here. You just can't. Like, you cannot launch a blockchain-based business here at this time without just true fear of an entire definite issue versus being welcomed both from a business perspective, a tax perspective, and a variety of other things. So there's some trade-offs, but clearly there's enough to take a look at. And before you think about Europe or Asia or a variety of others, you know, LATAM really needs to kind of, you know, pump up and continue to talk like this. So thank you guys so much. Real quick, round it out. Where can people find you if they want to tell you how much they love the episode?
LinkedIn is an easy place to find me. Lucia Gallardo on LinkedIn. Yeah, I think I'm pretty responsive on it. Not on X.
I'm on X, but I don't think I've posted in like 10 years.
Yeah, I don't. It became really toxic. And so now I don't even check. Now it's also, I'm like flooded with notifications of like, you might be interested in this post. And I'm like, A, I don't really want to like go and hunt how to like prevent this from happening, but B, I also just don't want to open the app at all. So I don't. I rarely open it. And even when I do, I think my time spent on app lasts at like 3 minutes max. And so I'm just not like the toxicity was too much for me, but I love other forms of social media and I'm highly responsive on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Joanna.
That makes two of us. I'm highly responsive on LinkedIn and Instagram. Mm. I am very fond of Instagram. X, again, I do have it, but I don't really interact with too much with the platform. I just like to read on and off. If I am bored and there's nothing else to do, or I already read the news or whatever, I'll go on it. But honestly, I agree fully with Lucia. It is a very toxic network. So,
Inner City Press, the Inner City Press account on X is the only thing I will look at these days because they do real time updates from the Southern District of New York, which processes a lot of international jurisdiction cases that are super interesting. So I will follow them. Yay, Inner City Press.
I will make note of it to follow them. Let's check out what they're thinking and talking about.
Why Whales? Yeah. We'll see you guys next time.
All right. Thank you. Bye, guys.
Why Whales was founded in 2021 by Jay Steinbeck, a passionate entrepreneur and business owner, with the purpose of bringing YPO and YNG members together in the cryptoverse. Why Whales is a collaborative and confidential community centered around cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, an exclusive crypto hub of more than 600 members. To be notified when we release new content, please subscribe to our show in your preferred listening app. For more information, visit www.ywhales.com. YWales is not affiliated with YPO, but at this time only allow for YPO, YPO Gold, and YNG members due to privacy and confidentiality. Support and production for today's episode was done by Truthwork Media. Nothing in the podcast constitutes professional and/or financial advice, nor does any information on the podcast constitute a comprehensive or complete statement of the matters discussed or the law relating thereto.